With regard to genetic modification of organisms, for me, it's always been an interesting question of to what extent is genetic engineering a possibility as an unfolding of God's creation, and what place might it have in that unfolding with regard to human interaction as being agents of that unfolding. And also, in light of one of the previous ones in the before the break, it struck me with regard to, does it have a role in terms of the redemption of the creation? Those are ongoing questions which certainly I find intriguing, and perhaps my comments here may contribute some thoughts with regard to that question. Personally, I do think that genetic engineering does have a potential place in that unfolding. But that raises the question, are there some limits to that unfolding? And are there some guidelines with regard to that? And given that, also is a question of to what extent is it appropriate to patent such genetic engineering products? That's a kind of a corollary to it. So I will try to touch on both of those aspects. Okay, as a bit of an overview, I want to just have a short discussion of two significant court cases that dealt with genetic engineering. And then I want to look at the question of what really is a gene? If we are talking about genetic engineering and the patenting of genes, what is it that is being patented? And then look, consider the rationale and some of the ethics related to that. And also, since one of the arguments for modifying organisms, particularly with regard to crops, is that, well, we need to do so in terms of feeding the 9 to 10 billion people that we're going to have in another 50 years. And so that rationale has been kind of at least from the biotech industry, a rationale for that. And related to that, finally, what I would consider to be the ethics of gene power. Okay, one of the first important court case, Supreme Court case that related to genetic engineering was the one in 1980, Diamond versus Chakrabarty, and that particular, and the second one that I want to touch on is the one that the Supreme Court dealt with a year ago, in terms of the Association of Molecular Pathology versus the company Myriad Genetics that had a patent on the BRCA genes, the breast cancer genes. Just to overview the criteria for a patent with regard to the U.S. Patent Office, et cetera, is it useful? Is it novel? Namely, did it not previously exist? Is it non-obvious? And it also does require some inventive step or action. So applying these criteria, different people can have different views on that, but those are the fundamental criteria with regard to patents. Looking briefly at then the 1980 Supreme Court case, the issue was indeed the patenting of a life form. Prior to that, life forms could not have a patent, and the patent office considered that any living forms was not patentable. What was actually created by Chakrabarty in that particular case? Did he really create an oil-digesting bacterium? What he had done was essentially he had discovered, and that was known, that certain bacteria in their plasmids have an oil-digesting gene, and he combined some of those different oil-digesting genes into a plasmid, and then having created that, and that's probably where the real creation is, then mixing those plasmids containing such oil digesting genes with the more hardy Pseudomonas bacterium that then took up the plasmid as the bacteria are wont to do. So in terms of the insertion of the plasmid into them, he's taken advantage of a feature that bacteria tend to do. So the key element probably, I would think, in the creation is the formation of the plasmids rather than the bacteria. Nevertheless, it was a request for the patent on the bacterium as such that was applied for and was granted. That decision was 5-4 in favor of Chakrabarty and GE, a company that he was working for. So you can see that here, a critical decision with regard to that was almost a very split decision. It wasn't unanimous. But once that decision is made, that really sets a pattern for a long time. In fact, Chief Justice Warren Burger, who was wrote the majority, he made the comment, which is rather remarkable, that anything under the sun that is made by man could be patented. In other words, whether it's living or non-living, that's really irrelevant. And if it's made by man, it's patentable. And as I already indicated, the question is, what is really made here? That becomes an ongoing question. And perhaps set up the stage also why many people have continued to raise a question with regard to modifying organisms. So the question is, was this bacterium a product of nature or a human invention? And with regard to living organisms, modifying them also implies that you are always dealing with a living organism as such in terms of that modification. You're not modifying the total organism. Perhaps you're modifying a certain aspect of it. By way of analogy, I could perhaps ask, when someone has a patent, say, on a carburetor for an automobile, and that carburetor gets inserted into the automobile, the patent still is not on the whole automobile. Whether that's a fair analysis, I think it's important to recognize those kinds of comparisons. Furthermore, when you have a living organism, is it a patent simply on that organism or on the whole, since organisms reproduce, is it appropriate to patent all of the reproductive offsprings? In other words, to put it in another way, does it mean to have a patent on a self-replicating organism? Does owning life, for example, owning a mule versus owning mule? You see that distinction? In other words, it's one thing to have a patent on this organism that you reproduced or that you made by combining the plasmids with the bacterium. But what about all the offspring from that? In what way does your patent claim a patent on all of the offspring? And that's where, of course, patenting living things is different from, say, patenting a carburetor for a car or some other device. Because when you patent a carburetor, you got to continue to make those carburetors. Living organisms are self-reproducing. And so that becomes an important issue, I would say, and part of the whole dialogue that should continue. I'm just raising that here and raising it by that distinction, and I'm using the mule because we didn't have mules, but then all of a sudden some farmer recognized that maybe I could cross this donkey with this horse, I get a mule. It's something new. And in the criteria of the 1980 case, if that were to happen now, we never had a mule before that, supposedly then that rancher could have a patent on that mule. And then the question is, could they also then have a patent on muleness, any mule that came from that? That becomes, I think, part of the issues that are involved when we're dealing with living organisms. Okay, a year ago, we had another important court case, and the key issue was, can a human gene be patented? This involved the patents on the breast cancer genes, the BRCA1 and BRCA2. The court decision, and again, it was a split decision, 5-4 decision, that genes are a product of nature and thus could not be patented. This was, in some sense, in contrast to all of the genes that had been patented for the last 20 years on a number of organisms, including human genes. So that was, in that sense, a pretty hallmark decision. And I think it still is perhaps in question, to what extent does this decision with regard to human genes apply to genes in other organisms? To what extent will those cases come back up to the court? Will the court have to redefine that? Or can the patent office basically take that decision and itself apply it to other genes? The decision did not have clarity on that, at least from my reading of that decision. They also did indicate that complementary DNA, cDNA, which they refer to as a synthetic molecule, is not a product of nature, and thus could potentially still be patented. This, I think, raises an interesting question, whether that's the case. To what extent is complementary DNA synthetic? Since, to some extent, the information, in fact, it's basically complementary DNA, if you are perhaps aware, you isolate messenger RNA, and from that, using a reverse transcriptase enzyme, you make the complementary DNA. The information is already there because the messenger RNA, which is made from the DNA, that complementary information is already in the DNA. So complementary DNA, apart from the fact that the introns, the intervening sequences, are not there, the information is still there. So it becomes an interesting question: to what extent is it or is it not a product of nature? I'm not going to go into it. I just want to raise that issue, since I guess I would argue that in many ways it's not a new product, because it's already there. And even though it doesn't have the intron, doesn't mean that the basic information of that particular complementary DNA isn't already in it. In fact, it is in the cells from the complementary information from which the mRNA is made and transcribed. Okay, this decision raises some important issues, and I want to continue that, raising some more questions, perhaps a deeper question, which I would consider a more philosophical question of, when we patent a gene, as we have been doing, what is it that we're patenting? In other words, what is a gene? And perhaps our view of genes, our operative definition of genes and the way we view them, perhaps reflect what I would consider a reductionist view of genes and of DNA rather than a holistic one. In other words, can living beings be reduced to genes or DNA? DNA as information is not just a molecule. The fact that it has information in its sequence, goes beyond the fact that it is simply a nucleic acid. And so in that regard, I would say that the modus for patenting with regard to genes is a separate issue from engaging in genetic engineering itself. And those are issues that we need to ask ourselves. So going a bit further into the question, what is a gene? As I've indicated, there's a tendency towards a mechanistic, reductionist, materialist interpretation. Even the expression, DNA is blueprint. What does it mean? Does a DNA molecule say, okay, I'm a blueprint, and now I've got all the information for the cell structure, the individual growth, the development of it? Put it very simply, in a simpler way, I've got blue eyes. Is there really a gene for blue eyes? Or do I have blue eyes because there is a gene for an enzyme that makes a pigment, a brown pigment, and I happen to have a defective gene for that? So in what way do I have a gene for blue eyes? Our language, I think, tends to be reductionist. The fact that I've got blue eyes, or you might have brown eyes or some other, is essentially the fact that there is information here, but that information requires a context for its expression. And without that context, that genes really don't have that full meaning. So I could ask that with regard to that. In fact, an interesting one when it comes to development is there really a gene for the shape of your nose? Obviously, the expression of genes in the context of cell and through the development of the embryo, in the interplay of its environment, is going to have a back and forth relationship that may then and will eventually result in some development that could develop your nose. But I would suggest that there is no particular gene or even a set of genes that says this is your nose. So I think becomes important there. So in ways, perhaps if we talk about blueprints, shouldn't we rather talk about a development program rather than a genetic program. Because it's a development program. There is some program which provides a context within which genes are expressed in some ways. Perhaps another way to put that is to raise it in this question. Is the gene the subject, namely the causal agent, or is it the object of the cell or development program? In other words, with regard to the function of genes, to what extent is its role the result of the cell and the organism, the environment, working on the genes? So in that sense, it would be an object of that control, which then results in its expression. It isn't simply a causal agent that results in a particular product. And I, for example, a gene, blue eyes. I've got blue eyes because of a whole genetic program of that interplay with regard to that. I've got five fingers because of an interplay of a genetic, of a development program that works on the DNA. So I think that kind of a language indicates that we need to break from a reductionist view of a gene, genes as particle then which are there as causal agents with regard to their impact. And that relates also to the central dogma of DNA to RNA to protein. That dogma has, I think, very much shaped a strong tendency towards a reductionism. Likewise, to illustrate this, that central dogma also has the element of one gene, one protein. Well, we know that certainly since the Human Genome Project, but even outside of that, we know that whatever a gene is, and that becomes an interesting question, that a particular region of DNA may have many proteins coming from that. Due to alternate splicing of the spliceosome, we get different mRNAs. So in other words, we have a particular segment of DNA, and what that information is in terms of its expression is very much dependent upon how the environmental factors in the cell act upon that DNA. So some sections, and we've tended to call those genes, may result in hundreds of proteins. So then what is a gene? If a gene can actually have information for dozens and hundreds of proteins, how does that impact our definition of a gene? So if we patent, say, a particular gene, what does that mean? Does it mean that we are patenting all of the impacts in terms of those relationships? And if it indeed has information for hundreds of proteins, are we then patenting all of those likewise? If we just take a textbook definition, one by Benjamin Lewis in his, he's written a whole series of 30 books on genes, and this is from Genes 8, 204. The glossary, a gene is a segment of DNA involved in producing a polypeptide chain. Involved, it doesn't necessarily, it's not entirely the only causal agent. It includes regions preceding and following in the coding region, leader and tailor, as well as intervening sequences between the individual coding segments. Having said that, then the question is that I'm raising is, how does alternative splicing providing for different polypeptides fit into this definition? He's still defining this in terms of a one-to-one relationship, but when you've got alternative splicing, what does that mean? And how does the genes as causal agents reflect the, well, in that sense, we also know that the location of a section of in the chromosome also impacts the information that's there. So we have a relational situation. Okay, so basically what I'm trying to argue is that genes have a context, have an environment. And thus, a gene cannot really be isolated from its context or the environment. Because when you isolate a segment of DNA, you've essentially isolated a reduced particle apart from its context. But then you don't have a gene anymore, because genes can only have significance within that context. So having said that, my point here is that genes within DNA are defined by relationships. A genes, cell, organism, environmental community. And I would argue that you can't patent or own relationships. You might have a particle that you might try to prescribe, but relationships you can't own. An analogy there is, say, to factory farms, where a food company owns the chickens or pigs. I would say that kind of situation is anormative. A farmer that just grows the animals, that situation is violating the relationships between farmer and animals. When a farmer no longer owns them, but another company does, there is something that's violating that relationship there. But also consider the relationship between employer and employee. Employers don't own employees. We've considered slavery to be immoral. Likewise, parents and child relationships. Parents don't own children. There is a relationship with obligations, but there's not one of ownership. So my point by these analogies is to say that relationships cannot be owned, and I would, by inference, say patented. I'm going to skip this in view of the time. I want to skip through some of the contents there. And so the basic question that I want to leave with you is, what is a gene? And if a gene can be patented, what is patented? And I've been arguing that we've been patenting a reduced notion of a gene, and that violates essentially the role of the gene. And if it's a cell and not the inventor that makes the copies of the gene, how does the patent apply to copies? And that's something which I don't think the courts have addressed, but what is there inherent about modifying a particular one to the offspring of that? And that becomes an important issue, particularly when if you have a crop that in which the pollen goes to neighboring fields and the courts have upheld that, they still own even those plants that have been affected and modified by that pollen, that is saying something remarkable with regard to ownership. So what's some of the rationale? Some important ones for genetic engineering is pharmaceuticals. Perhaps also developing crops that can indeed improve or give us crops that can deal with environmental challenges, whether that be temperature or salt areas or water areas. It can also give us increased growth. But are those raise important questions, whether to what extent that kind of modification is an aberration of God's unfolding or an improvement of God's unfolding. That doesn't take away from the value of modifying some crops. I think of the spot virus of the papaya in Hawaii, when Gonzalez modified those. I think it was very valuable for that local crop. Doing so, by the way, meant that he had to essentially get approval from a number of patents in order to even modify that crop. So in that sense, with regard to improving crops, perhaps for environmental and or food production situations, patents on the genes have a tendency to limit the research and the potential, not to open that up. So that would be, in my view, another rationale for avoiding the patents. And of course, one important issue is that modified crops can indeed reduce pesticide and herbicide use, and it can reduce soil erosion, but it also can contribute to essentially weaker ecosystems that are more sustainable. So by and large, the crops that have been modified have not necessarily increased sustainability because it's already accepted the industrial form of agriculture, which has not been sustainable by and large. And Dave Dornbusch's talk yesterday alluded to that. So indeed, if we are going to modify crops, it should be done within the context of improved agroecosystem sustainability, not simply comparing it to an industrial agriculture which has already been unsustainable. And that's the tendency that we have recently. And then finally, one comment that I want to indicate is that patenting genes and particular crops has contributed to an increasing power in the food industry that I guess I would say is inappropriate. Because food is a basic human need, should be accessible to those, and not under the control of a few corporations. So I'm going to end with that and give a few minutes for discussion.
So your conclusion would be that Monsanto shouldn't be allowed to own a patent on it?
That would be my conclusion, yeah. For the reasons of what a patent is, as well as the fact that it gives them immense power in the food industry.
One of the first things that comes to mind with me when it comes to genetically modified organisms, or even food for that matter, is the notion of side effects, especially in food. Has there been any debate regarding the modification of gene expression to side effects? Has that been looked into? Do you know much about that?
Well, which is interesting with regard to certainly modified crops. Up to even now, after about 20 years, we still have not done, the FDA still has not done adequate testing or developing an adequate testing protocol for are they safe. And the one case, at least one case where someone in England did indeed do a testing on modified potatoes in which he also not only fed the rats potatoes laced with the toxin, but also fed them the modified potato, what he discovered is that rats that ate the modified potato had indeed negative results in their intestinal system, not the potatoes that were laced with it. That pointed out that, essentially, that confirms that genes have a context, and when you put them into another organism, you're affecting more than one product. You're affecting a whole bunch of relationships. And if you're going to test the modified product, you've got to eat the whole product and test that. And we haven't been doing that. And now, very few people do, because what happened to him? After he then is the leader of that lab, encouraged him to go on TV to a program, the next day, he was out of his lab. Because Monsanto called Clinton, Clinton called Tony Blair, and Tony Blair called the director of that lab, and he was out of his lab the next day. Because of that public recognition that maybe the whole organism that's been modified isn't healthy. So we still don't have a good protocol. We're testing those.
Got a question in green. Okay. Another one? Back there? Yeah.
As you know, many of the new genes, some have been developed by the Gates Foundation and other people in mice and Rockefeller. But what would be the incentive for industry to develop new genes that could be potentially useful if they didn't have a patent protection?
Okay. Take the Green Revolution. Rockefeller Foundation founded the development of hybrid seeds. That whole initial first Green Revolution was essentially public funds and foundation funds. There were no patents on there. In other words, if things are really valuable, let us use public funds to support that research and not privatizing them by patents. And we've had it with the Green Revolution. I don't see why that argument holds for modified genes. Furthermore, if you have that, then you have the regulatory agency also that can perhaps support that kind of research. By patenting, essentially the kind of products that are being patented are the ones that are going to give the corporations profits. They're not motivated to essentially deal with the environmental improved products in, say, developing countries, which is what the Green Revolution did. It had negatives, but at least it did. It was a non-privatized effort, research effort.
One clarification here. I think you initially raised the question with regard to the genetically engineered bacteria of Chakrabarty. Is it just the bacterium that's been modified? Is that what's patentable, or is progeny patentable, and so on? Well, with respect to the progeny, a patent holder needs to have the progeny covered, or
right.
You know, these patents basically worthless.
Oh, I agree there, but my concern is that raises the issue of whether it's appropriate to patent an organism.
But as far as the ultimately, there will be progeny from that originally engineered bacterium that will be available for public use, and that's because the term of a patent is limited. So those organisms will become available to several generations down the road.
Presumably.
I think we actually need to stop and go take this offline because we're a little bit behind schedule.